body power. As much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
Now then, we've got a special football show for you this evening. You're all very welcome. Spurs, by the way, 1-1 with Southampton. Shane Long on the score sheet this evening for Southampton. He equalised. That is in the FA Cup. An hour gone. We'll keep you up to date between now and 10 o'clock. But, delighted to say, not talking to him down a Skype line, we have world soccer correspondent Paddy Agnew in studio in Dublin. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Hey. We're doing this face-to-face. We're just, just saying to the outside, it's nice to do this face-to-face for a change.
No, it's much easier for me too to be doing it face-to-face, I can tell you.
We put it out to the listeners, fire through all and any questions about Serie A down the years, because there is still a real love affair with the Italian league, prompted in part by James Richardson and by the golden age of Italian football in the 80s and 90s. And people still have that residual love for Italian football and the culture. Yeah, yeah. You went out there, Paddy, in 1985, am I right in saying?
Correct.
I know no more about that. Why did you go out there?
Well, before I answer that, I apologise to anybody who's... All three of you out there have read my book, Forza Italia, because I explained this story, but let me repeat myself. At the time... myself and my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, she was running a catering business in Dublin. It was a great idea. It would have made a lot of money in Celtic Ireland, but we were a bit ahead of our time and it didn't make any money. So she had to cut that, she had to close that down. And she was saying, oh, I'm going to, you know, this was 80s Ireland. It was Ireland that had just had the abortion or the amendment referendum, and it was Ireland that was just about to reject divorce, the first referendum. So it was a different Ireland, but there wasn't work. And Dima said, okay, I'm going back to Spain, because she'd lived and worked in Spain for many years, in Barcelona essentially. And I said, well, if you're going, I'm going too. I'm not going to hang around here. I was a sports editor of the Sunday Tribune at the time, which is a great job, and was working with Vincent Brown, which was always very interesting, and never a dull moment.
Sure, that's a big job. Big job to leave.
It was a big job to leave, and it was a lot of security. But I wanted a bit of a, I wanted an experience outside of Ireland. So the two of us filled the suitcase and off we headed, not knowing how it would work out. I had an idea in my head, a rough idea in my head, that having been the sports editor of the Irish Times, in the Sunday Tribune at the time. One of the big Irish sports stories of the time was Liam Brady, who was really a fantastic success in Italian soccer. He was a great player, as we all know, but he was a fantastic success. Oh, and you couldn't, and this was pre-internet, pre-satellite phone, pre-mobile phone, it was a different era. So if you were there on the spot, you were going to be able to come up with stuff that nobody else had. And I thought to myself, well, maybe as a freelancer, I'd be able to survive on that. And then I also thought, well, of course, you know, what's Italy? I didn't know anything about Italy. I didn't speak any Italian. I'd never even been to Italy in my life. I thought, well, there's the Vatican there, isn't there? And, you know, we're all crazy about religion in this country, so maybe I could learn a thing or two about the Vatican. Northern Irish Presbyterian, that I am.
So they let you in, did they?
They let me in, and they let me into the Vatican much more, and they still do, you know.
You didn't spontaneously combust or anything?
No. So I mean that. So it was on as.
Jeez, that's a whim. That's incredible.
It was on. Well, let me just. It was more. It was even more whimsical, you think, because Dimna was a great Hispanophile, as I said. She'd lived in Spain for years.
She was Irish.
And she's Irish, from Clontarf. Yeah. And Dimna wanted to go back to Spain. I studied French and German at university. I was a good linguist. The first time I went to France, I was 12. My French was really very good. And I wanted to go to Paris. And she said, no, I want to go to Barcelona. I said, I want to go to Paris. I said, all right, we'll have to take a neutral ground. Let's go to Italy.
Just like that.
Well, I already had a notion that.
Yeah, sure.
I had already worked on a couple of things about Italy in my head. Mm. But I mean, I knew a few things about Italy, but if I knew, I had known then what I now know about Italy, I'm not so sure if I'd have gone, because, you know, I had a lot of notions about Italy that were just bullshit. You know?
The romance of it all.
Oh, yeah, that's all horseshit. Let's say that quite clearly.
Because anytime I talk to you, I just imagine you know. Sitting around sipping an espresso with some beautiful court in front of you, you know.
Well, I drink a lot of coffee, and there's certainly a lot of beautiful places to drink your coffee in, but there are also a lot of other problems about living in Italy, and those problems remain.
So how did it work then on the football front? You went over in 85. At that stage, Brady had won two Serie A's with Juve and had since moved on because Platini, of course, famously took his spot. So Brady's still very much doing his thing. I think he was there until, what, 87? Yeah. So
he did 2 years with Sampdoria and then he did 2 years with Inter.
Yeah.
He was with Inter by the time I arrived.
Okay.
And one of the first things I said to myself, because I knew, I'd met Liam before, spent a week with him in London when he was an Arsenal player at one point for McGill magazine. But one of my first intentions was to make contact with Liam and say, look, I'm here and can we keep in contact and stuff. I had no contacts. I didn't know how to get through to him at the club. So one of the first games that was happening when I arrived there, I arrived, I say, in 85. It was, in fact, December 85. Mm. And one of the first games in January of 86 was Inter playing away to Pisa. Pisa, who are no longer Serie A side, but they were at that time. And myself and Dimna got on the train and up to Pisa we went. And I got myself credited for the game and went. I was hanging around at the end of the game. It was a historic game because Inter lost. Pisa beat them 1-0. First and only time in their history that Pisa have beaten Inter. And probably will never happen again. But anyway, at the end of the match, I was in their tiny little press room, which would have been about half the size of your studio here. And in the midst of the chaos and stuff, and I didn't see any sort of sign of an Inter players coming out or anything. There was nothing organised whatsoever, and it turned out the Inter players didn't have any press conference, so they just got onto the team bus. And I thought, what the fuck am I going to do? I beg your pardon. What am I going to do? And showed a rare piece of enterprise and initiative. I walked out around, it's a small stadium at Pisa, and I walked around to where the buses were parked. You couldn't do this sort of thing now, but
no.
I walked around to where the buses were parked, and I walked down to the Inter team bus. And standing on the doorsteps was Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. And I knew who he was, obviously.
Sure, yeah.
I knew he'd speak English. And I said, I'm an Irish reporter, could I get on here and talk to Liam Brady? And so Rummenigge turns around and shouts down the bus, said, Liam, there's an Irish reporter for you. And they let me on. And I walked down the bus to where Liam was sitting. And Liam looks at me and he says, Paddy, you shouldn't be on the bus. Shakes his head ruefully.
Oh, dear.
But however, Liam was actually, he turned out to be a big, big help in that first year.
He
didn't do anything for me in terms of getting established, but I knew nothing about Italian football, arguably not much more about football generally, but he was very patient and talked to me a lot. And told me a lot of different things about Italian football. So he was a great story at the time because he was a terrific player.
And there's a few people who've texted in because I said you were on at 7 o'clock when we came on air first, and I said you're going to be on. And a lot of people are very curious about Brady's time there. They know he was with Juve. They know he scored the winning penalty to win the league.
Yeah.
They know he went on to Inter. They know how good a player he was.
Yeah.
I suppose what people are curious in is the extent to which he was revered might be the strong word, but rated maybe by the Italian public and Italian pundits. Like,
well,
I wouldn't say in Liam's case
it revered is too strong a word.
Really?
He was one of the great foreigners as far as the Italians are concerned. You know, they're you're talking about very, very good players. You're talking about, it starts with Maradona, Platini, Zico, and worked on down, and he was part of that generation, and he was. That was the company he kept, and that was what he was seen as. And you know, I mean, when the avocat, the Gianni Agnelli, the patron of Juventus, decided on a whim that he'd buy Platini, it meant getting rid of Brady because in those days you could only have two foreigners. And Giampiero Boniperti, the great former striker at Juventus, but then he was the managing director, he called up Brady and I told him to come out the house. I got to talk to you. And basically, it was to tell him that the avocado had, the boss had gone, bought Platini, and he had to go. And the two of them basically ended up sort of crying their eyes out, because Boniperti had a huge, thought Brady was just a fantastic player. Brady was a very, very, very good player.
Oh, I know.
I remember years later, it was about 1994, it was the year of the American World Cup. Liam came over to Naples for one of the British TV companies to do a preview on Italy as World Cup. They were playing one of the World Cup warm-up games, and he came over to have a look at them. And I didn't know he was there. I was down for the same game. I've forgotten who Italy were playing, but it doesn't matter. And I was walking along the seafront in Naples, and who do I walk into but Liam. And I said, "Jeez, how are you, Liam?" And blah, blah. And we went, and I said, "Let's go and have a coffee." And we sit down in a bar in a fairly fashionable sort of place. And throughout the, maybe we sat and chatted for an hour and a half. Throughout the hour and a half, there was just a constant series of interruptions with people coming up to me and saying, you know, "Al Brady, grande Brady, che piacere rivederti," and all this sort of stuff. And people, you know, ma tu sei stato grandissimo, and all, you know, he was very much, Italian fans appreciated a good player, and he was one.
Yeah, no doubt. So Napoli at that period.
Yeah.
Diego has arrived.
Well, you know, as what I said to you before about the pre-mobile phones and pre-internet era, it was a great place to be a freelancer like I was then, in the sense that he was just about the biggest story in world football at the time. And he was, you know, if he wasn't scoring wonder goals, he was generating children outside his marriage, and he was getting into a jacuzzi with the Camorra. I mean, he was doing a lot of different things, and he was taking a lot of drugs, and he was still playing extraordinary football. He was an extraordinary figure, Maradona. But so I spent a lot of those first few years I was there. I mean, you remember, I'm someone who's gone to Italy and he doesn't speak any Italian. It takes a while to understand, to learn a language, to put it mildly. And so one thing that I used to say to people very cheerfully, well, you don't have to speak Italian to watch a football match and understand what's going on. And so I spent a lot of those days, a lot of that time, concentrating on football. And I spent a lot of time going down to Naples, and I saw Maradona many times play. And that, you know, one of your researchers said to me today, "What was your most, you know, what's your strongest footballing memories of Italy?" And there are those years, obviously, because of the first years, they make the biggest impression, but also because, let me say, like Maradona, there never was, and presumably won't be for some while, anything. I mean, he was just such an extraordinary player. And then he added on all those other things off the field that made him a figure of monumental.
Because him and Napoli, they won their first league title in 87.
Yeah, I was there the day they won that, yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen the new documentary? I presume you have.
No, I haven't seen that. My daughter keeps telling me to go and see it, and I haven't got around to it. Apparently it's good.
It'll bring you back. The extent to which the Mafia were in control of his life really is not surprising, but is still shocking, really, in reality, when you think about it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in Forza Italia, I tell a small story, but we knew about the time, but I had a good friend called Bruno Passarella, same as the surname as the player, but no relation. And Bruno was one of the major football correspondents for Argentina, and therefore he was in a small group of Argentine reporters who were in regular contact with Diego. And on the day we were down there at the San Paolo for the day they won the championship, and Bruno got a message from some of the Maradona clan, "There's going to be a celebration tonight in such and such a place. Be standing outside Gate C and the stadium at 6 o'clock, and a minibus will come along and pick you guys up." And the minibus came along, picked them up, and took them off to a place called Nola. Now, Nola is a suburb of Napoli, but it's quite some way outside the centre of Napoli. And when they got there, Bruno, who was the guy who, you know, was not a, this guy who'd worked for the Argentine embassy in his time, he gets out of the minibus and he looks up and he sees the things that look, they look almost like gun towers, like they're watchtowers outside this imposing walls leading into a villa. And they go into the villa and there is the most lavish party going on. There's bottles of wine, bottles of champagne being popped everywhere. And he, at one point, he gets into the loo, and it's you know, it's gold-fitted bathtubs, yeah, and taps and stuff. And Bruno said, I mean, it was obvious from after about, you know, if you know anything about Italy, after about 15 seconds, you were in a mafioso house, in this case, a Camorra house, designed along Scarface lines, you know. And, you know, you could say Diego didn't know who he was getting involved with, but I think that might be naive. I think he could not know.
Well, because Napoli were not a fashionable club for him to go to. Do you suspect he regretted that as the years went on? He was there for a long time. 84 to 91 was a good old stint.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know whether he regretted that, but what I would say to you about Maradona is that he was monstrously good, but if he'd trained properly, if he hadn't diverted into drugs, he would have been even better, which is just mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Somebody wants to know, are the ultras more or less powerful now than they were back in 80s, 90s?
That's a good question. It's a really good question. I don't know. I think it's very much at the same level. I'd like to have people say, oh no, they've dealt with the ultra problem. Some club presidents like Lotito, Lazio, has tried to fight a battle with them, and he's done better than many. But he did it at the cost of about three seasons where you'd have maybe 10,000 people going to a Lazio home game by way of protest, and the fact that he wasn't collaborating with the ultras, you know, giving them free tickets here and there, you know, or giving them a say in franchises, giving them maybe helping out with them travelling to away matches, whatever things that the other club presidents do, he wasn't doing them, and they waged a war against him, and I think they lost that war to some extent. Lazio is a more healthy club for that, and I'm glad to see, you know, they're, as we speak, they're playing tonight against Verona, a game that could take them to second place in the league.
Sunday was the football day, wasn't it?
In those days, yeah.
Yeah. Has that eroded now, the way kickoff times have just changed anyway? But it was Sunday.
Oh, absolutely.
So what was the deal there? Go to Mass in the morning and then football? Is that how they worked it? Or why Sunday?
No, just go to football.
Yeah, well.
No, I mean, Italy's a, how would I put it? It's, you know, 95% Catholic country, but it's 95% nominally Catholic country. How many committed and genuine Catholics there are remains to be seen.
Yes, okay. And these days, the Sunday thing has frittered away.
It's gone entirely. In those days, it was extraordinary. My memories of the first Sundays in Italy was of Italian men with little transistor radios, you know, nervously stumping up and down the pavements at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon as waiting for the kickoff at Serie A, because every match was played at 3 o'clock, and there was no live TV, so the only way you could get it was through listening to Tutti il Calcio Minuto per Minuto, you know, all the football minute by minute, which was still exists and is a very, very good radio program that follows all the matches all the time. So, you know, the guy's commentating the Juventus-Milan game, then all of a sudden the guy who's doing the commentary on Lazio breaks in, and Canario just scored a goal! You know, that sort of. Okay. And the entire Italy would listen to matches and it would listen to the entire Serie A program that way.
Fantastic.
Yeah, well.
Was in the 90s it changed and TV started coming in?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any Serie A free to air now across Italy?
Free to air? No.
It's gone?
No, it's all on...
Paywall?
It's all paywall. Mm. Sky Italia essentially have a thing called DAZN. Who do a fantastic job. Sky Italia are very good, but you don't get it for free.
And who are the main pundits on TV now? Who's the Gary Neville of Italian football right now?
The Sky Italia have the best punditry, and they have people like Billy Costacorta, former Milan player, Fabio Capello.
Is Capello good?
Capello's fantastic.
What kind of pundit is he?
Well, he's really tough. And he calls it exactly as it is.
Yeah, because he had a clash recently with Mancini, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He's had clash with various people. But he's not unpleasant and he's not looking for a fight, but he calls it really well. And, I was watching him. He was in the studio and he was asking Maurizio Sarri questions about Juventus' performance. And what was really interesting about it was the sound language, in the sense that Sarri was quite pleased to be talking to Capello and very different, very respective and deferential to Capello. Mm. Even though, normally the pundit is saying, well, what do you say? It was the other way around with Capello.
And we all associate Italian football, obviously, with a real tactical nous and a tactical focus. Is that represented in how they talk about the game?
Yes.
And how the game is televised? Is it about the tactics?
I watch a lot of the chats after games, and if you have people like Costacorta, Del Piero, Cambiasso, Capello talking about a game, I mean, it is mind-blowing what they say. And it's all about, he had two guys there in central defence when he should have moved one wide. And they're just pointing out things that, the average punter, certainly me, wouldn't necessarily arrive at.
Mm. In terms of the support around the country, who's the most supported team?
Juventus.
So would there be a big contingent of Juventus fans pretty much right across the country?
Yes, there is. That's a good question, because they're possibly the only team to whom that applies. Okay. No matter where you go, you're going to find Juventus supporters. I mean, at the I was at the Roma Juventus game in December. Juventus won 2-1. Mm. And one of the things that was unusual is that, there were Juventus fans all over the ground. The visiting fans are normally in one corner, small corner, at the Olympico of the stadium, but they were all over the place because there are Juventus fans in every city, yeah.
Okay. In terms of access then, like, that's an extraordinary story that you're managing to blag your way onto a bus. An Inter Milan bus as well.
So, you couldn't do that.
Well, I'm sure you couldn't. Through the late 80s, the great Milan team, you've got Maradona there. Like, how much access did you get? You're not getting into dressing rooms, are you?
Well, the first year I got into a dressing room after Roma Juventus came and found myself sitting beside Platini. Smoking a cigarette, by the way. Because Platini's the smoker. But he kept it very quiet. He was very clever, and you don't see many photographs of him smoking, but he used to smoke a cigarette. but you could walk into the dressing room and you could talk to him, you could try to talk to him.
I presume Platini, if you were asking him a question, he'd be saying, get out of my face, go away.
Yeah. He was, in a very elegant, nice way. I liked Platini, and I loved him as a player. I thought he was a wonderful player.
Who were the good characters for talking to you in the dressing room after games? Were there any that you got to know?
Well, you didn't, to be honest, no, you didn't get into the dressing room that often. One guy who I talked to a bit in those days, apart from Brady, I mean, I was speaking to the English language players. Do you remember Ray Wilkins, Butch Wilkins?
Oh, of course. Sadly, passed away recently.
Died quite recently, yeah.
I always thought he seemed like a lovely man on television.
He's a very nice man. Yeah. And he played for AC Milan. And I remember the first time I made contact with him, Milan were playing Ascoli in an Italian Cup game in a place called San Benedetto del Tronto, which is on the Adriatic coast. It's a seaside resort. And this was sort of the beginning of the season, early season. So the weather was still very warm. I remember going out there, and I got in contact with the club, and Ray got back to me, and he said, well, we're out playing this game. Come out to such and such a restaurant where we're based. And I go out to the restaurant, and we walk up and down the beach, me and Ray.
Very romantic.
Oh, yeah. But no, he was just a terribly nice guy. And he told me a lot of different things about what it was like in that Milan side. That Milan side had Nils Lidholm, the great Swede, was the coach, and Paolo Rossi, the World Cup winner, was their centre forward. Lidholm was still a great coach. Rossi was practically broken down. He never played well that season because he was at the end of his career. But I mean, Ray was very good, very, very sharp. And he was one of the, I mean, some of the British exports to Italian football, like, say, Jimmy Greaves or Ian Rush, didn't do terribly well. Like,
no.
Greaves scored 9 goals in 11 games, but he started to fight with Rocco, the legendary Milan coach, and he was home by Christmas. Ian Rush never really settled down on a mediocre Juventus side, and Boniperti used to buy him crates of Welsh ale to cheer him up, but it didn't really work.
What about Gaza?
But Butch was good.
What about Gaza? Did you come across him much?
I did, yeah. But he was of all the Anglophones that I've had dealings with in Italian soccer, he was the only one who, for me, was a complete disaster. I mean, he wasn't a disaster as a player, but I could make no contact. I couldn't communicate with him at all. I could never, you know, He didn't want to, he was he had such a bad relationship with the British media, which was not by any means all his fault.
No, yeah.
In fact, I would tend to say it was practically all the British media's fault, and particularly the tabloids. Mm. But it was just impossible. I gave up trying to.
He didn't want to know.
I gave up trying to. But on that same subject, let me just tell you something. I spent a morning about a week ago with Chris Smalling, who's, you know, first sort of one of the few Englishmen there at the moment, he's a very interesting guy in the sense that he's somebody who's trying to adapt and adapting successfully, trying to learn Italian, and a lot of interesting things to say about Italian football. But you know, he bucks that trend of Englishmen who didn't integrate. The person who integrated best of all that, of the old Anglophones, was our own Brady.
Yeah,
Brady was
like
very, very, well, I mean, you know, he stayed 7 seasons. 7 seasons as a foreigner in those days was unheard of.
And his Italian was good?
His Italian was good, yeah.
Yeah.
Is good, still is good.
What's Smalling saying about Italian football?
Well, there are a number of things we talked about. The first one is, you know, you might think that he's sitting there sort of licking his wounds because he's not playing for Man United anymore and he's out of the English team for 2 years and, you know, he's Napoleon in exile at Santa Elena and what a disaster. Mm. But not at all, he's delighted. He had his first Christmas in Rome. They didn't, you know, want to go home at all. The delight of Rome was a lovely, it was beautiful Christmas with us, the weather wise, and he had a great time. And he settled down remarkably, it seems to me. He's working hard at learning Italian. He's got, you know, a teacher teaching him Italian. And what he said, I said to him, you decided, you know, this move came very quickly. He said, yeah, Solskjaer called him in one morning at United and said, look, there's been an offer for you from Roma. And the club are interested. Do you want it? And he said, next morning I was in Rome talking to Paulo Fonseca, the Portuguese coach of Roma, and said it was done and dusted in 48 hours, which is pretty quick by transfer standards. A transfer it wasn't a transfer, it's a loan, but a 3 million one. It was still pretty quick. I said, well, how come you decided so quickly? And he said, well, you know, I'm 30 now. How many more offers like this are going to come along, essentially? And I didn't want to be in a situation where I spent the rest of my life regretting I didn't take that opportunity. And I'm delighted I have done.
Mm. And he's playing very well.
Yeah, but then he was also a very interesting guy to talk to because he's been involved. He's come across the great problem of racism in Italian football very early on in his experience there. Because do you remember there was a major row? Was November when Italy were Roma were playing an away game against Inter Milan.
Black Friday.
Yeah, the Corriere dello Sport had the brainwave of an idea putting that headline on. And I asked him about that and I said, did you find that offensive and insulting? And he said, you just look at it and you think, you know, why come, you know, mainstream publication actually even can have that as a headline? And I said, yeah, and then what about the three monkeys that the Italian Federation wanted to use 2 weeks later as a campaign against racism, a piece of complete and utter stupidity? And he said, well, Yeah, when I saw that, I couldn't believe that was for real. I couldn't believe it was for real. I mean, after all the fuss had been about Black Friday, they're going to do that. I mean, and then he said, but you know what? I mean, you're disappointed, and I'm disappointed by that. But then I think this is just about, at the end of the day, it's a question of education.
Well, we spoke around that time, and I got to go to a quick ad break here. I knew time would be against us in this chat, but you made a very interesting observation, which was picked up in The Telegraph, actually, a piece somebody had written, and we talked about it one evening here. And it was that effectively, Italy has been a net exporter of people for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that really, they're only at the beginning of dealing with faces that don't look like their own in relative terms. I don't know when we're talking about here, maybe even the 90s, a bit beyond.
90s, yeah.
Beyond, I suppose. I mean, you've got the Ruud Gullits of the world and players like that.
Yeah,
you're talking about mainstream society.
You're talking about, we're talking about mid-80s anyway.
Mid-80s, okay.
But I mean, you're right. The point is, like big European countries like Britain and France had to deal with their own colour or coloured colonies. Mm. Black people coming from, you know, North Africa into France. Black people coming from Jamaica to England in just immediately after World War II, and they've had time to integrate them. Mm. They've tried to integrate them and successfully integrate them in lots of places. But Italians haven't, even today. They're a long way behind on this particular.
You said even today, the jobs that can and can't be done by people of non-white people. It's almost regimented, like with taxi drivers.
Yeah, that's why I was saying that. I mean, bus drivers, taxi drivers, bank clerks, you know, essentially, as far as a certain Italian mentality is concerned, black people are good for harvesting the oranges and the grapes. They're good for rubbish collection. They're good for... Well, I'm not sure what else to say they're good for.
And that's endured. That is, we're done 2020 we're talking about here.
Well, I mean, not everybody.
I know.
Not everybody thinks that way. But there are a lot of people still find it. You know, you still get people saying, well, Balotelli's not really Italian.
Yeah,
now, Balotelli has practically never, you know, until he went to England, he never lived a moment of his life outside of Italy.
Yeah. We'll take a short break. We're back with Paddy Agnew. Get your texts in and we'll talk more Serie A in just a second.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
Now, welcome back. We're in studio with Paddy Agnew, who's usually joining us from Italy. So it's great to have him here. Lots of texts coming in. Paddy's a hidden gem of knowledge. I love listening to him talk about Italian football, says Adele. So you've got one fan out there at least.
Well, that's a start.
Colin wants to know, is it easy to buy tickets for matches generally?
It's got a lot easier, and most of the clubs, I mean, I don't buy tickets for matches very often, but when people ask me to, it's for Roma games because they're coming and staying and they're going to a game, and you can buy tickets for the Roma and Lazio games without any difficulty on the web, or at least I've managed to do it so far.
Mm. Please ask Paddy, why has Italian football plummeted from space age stadia in Italia 90 and what was then the top league in the world to the depths we've seen? Money for a start.
I mean, it's not just money, it's mismanagement. They were, your listener's absolutely right to say they were at the top of the world game, but it was mismanaged, badly mismanaged. And one of the things they didn't get right was stadia. They didn't work out, they need to get the stadiums sorted out. And they got overtaken by the technological, technological revolution, didn't move fast enough in relation to satellite TV coverage. And the Premiership very quickly did it much, much better. And as soon as the Premiership starts to do it better, it becomes more successful, it attracts it has more money, it pays people more money, and all the best players go there instead of going to Italy as they once did.
Mm. I should mention Daniel Maldini, 35 years after his father Paolo.
Yeah, played
for Milan, made his debut at 18 years of age, debut for Milan, and 66 years after Cesare Maldini.
Father, that's right, yeah.
So three generations of Maldinis playing for Milan is quite incredible.
Yeah. I don't know the kid, but I know both his father and his grandfather. I talked to both of them a lot over the years. Paolo's Paolo was a wonderful player.
He's a very handsome man as well.
A very handsome, very good looking lad. Let me tell you about that. on the build up to 1990, you know, Italia 90, the Irish team trained at a training camp in Malta. And some of us, in those days I was with the Irish team, and I went out to, from Rome, I went across to Malta to join the Irish team and watch them there for their 2 weeks of training, whatever it was. And I remember one night we're sitting in the bar with Jack. And he didn't sit in the bar certainly not with me very often, but he was there that night and he was chatting away. And somebody said to him, how do you rate their left back? The Maldini fella. And Jack said, ooh, is he the pretty fella? he's good. Jack knew a good footballer when he saw one. And Maldini was a wonderful player. He was a wonderful player. But at one point in my travails, I had a job. I used to do interviews for ESPN. And one of the guys I was often asked to interview was Paolo.
Right.
And so I got used to him, and he was just one of nature's gentlemen, and a guy, but also a guy, you know, who would think a lot, and you know, he just wouldn't give you a cliched answer. He'd try to answer your
intelligent
questions. He was intelligent. And his father were Cesare, was a terribly nice man too. Not as good a player as Paolo, frankly, but a good coach too. A bit old fashioned in his ways, but you know, I can imagine that you know, around the Maldini Sunday dinner table, the talk was of football and little else.
Yeah. So now, Daniel, no pressure at 18 years of age to follow in Paolo's footsteps. Goodness me. Yeah, is he meant to be good? What's the word on him?
I don't know, to be honest. I haven't seen him, so I wouldn't.
I wanted to ask you, so someone's asking, and it'll segue into the point I wanted to bring up as well and get your thoughts on, your favourite team of the 90s in Italian football, wonders Niall and Stony Batter, because his favourite were the Parma side, who were great to watch.
Parma side were great. They're not a bad choice. Favourite team of the 90s, well, I mean, the 90s were the best team that were, surely was Capello's AC Milan, the one that you know, went through a season unbeaten, beat Barcelona 4-0 in the Champions League, or Champions Cup finals it was then. Was it a Champions Cup final? The one in Athens. But they were, that was, you know, a very, very good team. People like Savicevic, Boban, you know, they could play quite a bit.
The great Juventus team in the 90s.
Yeah.
To what
Lippi's team, yeah.
Yeah. To what extent, so there's the accusations of something untoward going on when it comes to doping have been thrown at that team. And famously, the club doctor, Riccardo Agricola, was given a suspended prison sentence for providing performance-enhancing drugs, specifically EPO, to the players. He was then acquitted on appeal the following year. And there was plenty of damning testimony. Like, one of the expert witnesses, a doctor at the trial, said the variability I saw in the data could not be considered normal. He talked about hemoglobin levels in red blood cells that could only be explained by blood transfusions or by the use of EPO, was his opinion. Juventus have denied this right through the years. To what extent has that hung over Juventus, or has that been kind of brushed aside?
It's been completely forgotten.
Completely forgotten, right.
Okay. I mean, Paddy Agnew wrote a chapter about it in Forza Italia, but it's still got forgotten. Yeah. I mean, what the you know, the play in the there was a trial in Turin, and the players came into court and they said, yeah, we used to take this and we used to take that. We took whatever the club doctor told us as we thought it was.
Didn't
ask questions. But the accusation was that they were being given a lot of EPO, and also that they were being given a type of medicine which would be required from somebody recovering from serious brain surgery. And why would you give that to footballers?
Had any of them had brain surgery?
No, not that, as far as we know, no. And so there was a suspicion that, you know, Juventus were using all sorts of substances of a supplementive nature that maybe they overuse. Yeah. However, I would say one thing about it. I would ask you, were Juventus the only team doing that at that point? I suspect not. Mm. I strongly suspect not in not just Italian football, but particularly in Italian football.
Mm. Are there ongoing suspicions that has continued in Italian football or that it's cleaned up its act? If you don't know, you don't know.
You don't know. Obviously, I don't know. But I don't think it is. I don't think that. I think the use of EPO, for example, has been cleaned up a lot. Yeah. It's much more carefully controlled. Mm.
Somebody wants to know what's happening with Roma's new stadium plans.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I know what's going on here.
Well, you know, was it 4 years ago, I went to a press conference with James Palotta, the American owner, or the American head of the consortium that owns Roma at the moment, right? And which is selling Roma at the moment to another American called Friedkin. But they had a PR firm called, Fleischmann Bauer or something, who were basically New York based. But there was an Irish guy working for them. And I was talking to him as we were hanging around waiting for the press conference to take place. And he said to me, well, Paddy, you know Italy. So what do you think? What chance of we get this stadium up and running? I said, well, you know, Jimmy or whatever his name was, this is about the sixth time I've been to a press conference at Roma outlining their plans for a new stadium. And none of the others seem to have worked, so I'm not too sure about how much this one will work. And he was very disappointed by my answer. But, I mean, 4 years down the line, it's longer actually, it hasn't happened. The last week, Virginia Raggi, the mayor of Rome, said that, she said that it's not over yet and there's still a possibility it'll get done. I would remain skeptical about it. There's a suspicion that Palotta was interested in buying Roma essentially because a part of the deal would be able to build the stadium, and he'd also be able to have a major housing development along with the stadium. Now he wants to sell the club, and many of us think that the reason that he wants to sell the club is because he's been stolen this building, and there was no question of him being allowed to do any non-sports building.
Right. To what extent is the game still very much the game in Italy? Its popularity has endured, I presume. Are there other sports that it's now competing with in a bigger way than previously?
No, it doesn't compete with anything. It's football first and everything else is second. Other sports do better now than they did before. I mean, sports like cycling, Formula One, basketball, tennis, all are very much followed, but nothing comes near football. Mm. Nothing comes near football. Mm. I mean, you know, I've been on an Italian TV. I remember the night that Ireland beat Italy, I was in Rai 1. And
in Rai 94.
Uno, yeah, yeah. I was in the studio, I guess. And we had an audience of 22 million.
Oh, God.
No, I mean, football is... Football is serious business, isn't it?
Serious business. Lazio and Verona drew nil all, by the way. So Juventus stay 54 points, Inter 51 and Lazio.
No, that's a pity for Lazio. I'd like to have seen them win tonight because that would have...
Is Juve's dominance not getting a bit boring for everybody, no?
I think it is for a lot of people, but not for the Juventus fans.
No, I'm sure. So, listen, it's been great having you in. I guess you're back to Italy very shortly and... covering the football, amongst other things.
We have the Milan derby this weekend.
Oh, do you? Okay. Yeah. San Siro is... What's the story there?
There's another... The Italian football is catching up slowly but surely with the whole problem of their stadium.
Because Juve have done a great job.
They've done a great job. Yeah. It is an absolute state-of-the-art stadium. It's a great one. I think there's a chance there. I believe that they will have a new stadium in Milan. It'll be...
Does the San Siro need to be replaced? Just the traditionalist in me never wants it to go.
Well, it's a fantastic stadium. Yeah. I wouldn't replace it, but they say two things: that it's probably too big for a lot of games,
okay,
and that it's also it's a very old stadium, actually, that's been rebuilt, and they're not so sure how safe it is. There are safety problems there as well. I think they will build a new stadium. I think it'll be a different stadium, but it'll be literally across the road from where San Siro is now.
Mm, okay. So when can people read the Chris Smalling interview? Is it out?
It's in World Soccer magazine, the March issue, which comes out at the end of this month, end of February.
Great. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure having you in. Good to tune in.
It's been a pleasure being here.
Yeah. By all means, pop back anytime you're in town. So, Paddy Agnew, we'll take a short break. Thanks a million, Paddy.
Thank you.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.